8 minutes past seven now. Caroline Murphy is with us to tell us what it says in today's papers.
So what next? Well, for a start, there will be more tapes, so says the lead story in the Irish Independent today. We're told a separate batch of explosive Anglo tapes reveal what was really going on as executives scrambled to save the stricken lender. The paper says these tapes are being analysed by the Independent Investigation Team and they shed much new light on the hours ahead of the guarantee and the machinations involving bankers and politicians. They put politicians firmly in the spotlight, we're told, and that a fourth senior Anglo executive enters the frame in these tapes for the first time. And the paper, meanwhile, headlines just one thing we will apparently hear when extracts from those tapes do come to light. Another day, another billion laughs, Drum, is what it says. We're told David Drum is heard laughing with a senior executive about the hemorrhage of funds from the institution hours before the government bank guarantee. But it's what next from the government that makes the lead in the Irish Times and the Irish Daily Mail and also the front of the Irish Examiner. Kenny, I'll uncover truth behind axis of collusion is the headline in the Examiner piece. We're told that Taoiseach rejected calls for an independent bank probe and pledged that an Oireachtas banking inquiry would be set up in the autumn. The Irish Daily Mail, however, is sceptical. No bank inquiry until 2015, if we get one at all, is the headline there, while referendum may be held to boost powers for bank inquiry is the headline in the Times. There, we're told, the electorate may be asked to vote again to give more power to politicians to conduct formal inquiries if the planned Oireachtas inquiry into the banking collapse fails to get full cooperation from leading figures involved. Not the way to go, though, appears to be the belief of Miriam Lord inside the paper. Writing about yesterday, she says, outside Leinster House, people are furious with the arrogant suits. Their laddish sniggering shocked the public, a public that considered itself unshockable after the economic turn of events of the last few years. Yet, God bless their innocence, many still turned towards the government to see what they would do about it. And what steps does the Taoiseach propose to take, she asks before answering. It seems Enda intends to play politics with this dispiriting situation, the way Anglo's rugger buggers played with our future. And she says of Mr. Kenny's intention to use a parliamentary inquiry and moral authority, that'll put the wind up the bankers. Enda holds the same sort of moral authority over them as the Catholic bishops hold over him. Was it moral authority, meanwhile, that Labour TDs used to get their minister to reverse some cuts to special needs education resources? That decision makes the lead in the Examiner today. Quinn left red-faced as resource cuts reversed is the headline there. The resources which will be available to compensate former residents of Magdalen Laundries make the front of the Times. We're told details of a €25 million fund will be disclosed by Alan Shatter today. But finally this morning, huge coverage today too of the fund which will be available to that lucky Euro Millions lottery winner. You heard about it in the bulletin. You can read about it in the papers. News of the Irish win is splashed all over the front of the Irish Daily Star, the Irish Daily Mirror and the Irish Sun. So check that ticket as the Star asks, are these your numbers?
Caroline, thank you for coming up to 12 minutes past seven. Emma McNamara is here with news of some numbers in business.
That's right, Cathal. While demand for credit among small and medium-sized businesses remains low, almost one in five loan applications is still being declined by the banks. That's according to a new survey commissioned by the Department of Finance. The survey by Red Sea also shows an increase in loan refusals among the non-pillar banks. There have been, though, improvements in turnover performance among medium-sized businesses, which led to a small increase in those looking for finance. The figures, which are for October last year to March this year, show demand at 40%, up from 39% in the previous survey and 38% a year ago. The decline rate at the pillar banks, AIB and Bank of Ireland, is unchanged from last September at 18%, but the report points to an increase in the decline rate for non-pillar banks from 21% in September to 24%. And we'll have more on this at 10 to 8. Eason, the book and stationery group, recorded a pre-tax profit of 3.1 million for the year to the end of last January. It was the first time in 5 years the company recorded a profit. Most of this was down to payroll savings of 3.1 million from a restructuring plan that saw the headcount there fall by 224 staff. And in the US, bookstore chain Barnes & Noble has seen its fourth quarter net loss more than double to $118.6 million as sales of its Nook ebooks and devices continue to drop. Also in the US, home prices have seen their biggest annual rise since 2006. The Standard & Poor's Case-Shiller Index, which monitors single-family home prices across 20 cities, rose by 12.1% in April compared to the same month last year. The jump, due to increasing demand and shortage of supply, was bigger than analysts expected and is being seen as a good omen for growth in the American economy. All cities except Detroit experienced year-on-year rises, with 12 posting double-digit gains, and San Francisco saw home prices rise by more than 20% over the year. On the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at $1.3074 and at 84.68 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you very much.
Welcome back. It's 7:15 and we begin with a question. We'd all like to know the answer to what happened and why when our government gave banks who told lies an unlimited guarantee 5 years ago. The Taoiseach said in the Dáil yesterday he believed that legislation currently going through the Houses of the Oireachtas would provide a process for a parliamentary inquiry which could lead to the truth. He said that process would start and he wanted to find out what happened. The question is, what are the means and what are the prospects? We're joined by John O'Dowd, lecturer in law at UCD. Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you spell out for us, just as things stand and as things will stand after this legislation is passed, as presumably it will be, what are the options?
Well, there seem to be three different kinds of inquiry you could have. You could have the traditional tribunal of inquiry under a judge or a group of judges, perhaps assisted by experts, which would be given terms of reference by the Oireachtas to look into particular events or transactions.
And given all that's happened, almost certainly out of the question.
It seems very unlikely. The government seems very reluctant to go down that road.
Option two.
Option two would be another commission of investigation. We had the Nyberg Commission already, so that needn't be a judge, for example, as it wasn't in the Nyberg case, could be an expert of some kind.
And it's not public?
It's not public, no. The default with a tribunal is that it's public and it can sit in private if necessary. The default with a commission of investigation is the other way around, that essentially it operates behind closed doors. But comes out into the public if it thinks it's necessary for some specific reason. Now, again, the terms of reference would be the important issue there. Now, it's clear that a tribunal, both a tribunal and a commission of investigation can make findings of personal culpability against individuals. It can blame people, can form an opinion that certain individuals behaved improperly or even illegally and put that on the record in terms of its final report.
So, but where we're at is what the Taoiseach spoke about, a parliamentary inquiry.
Yes.
So what, okay, assuming we get a parliamentary inquiry with the legislation which we're told will strengthen the powers insofar as that's possible of an inquiry, what are we talking about with what powers?
Well, they have to go forward within the constraints of the Constitution, the Abilara decision from over a decade ago now. And since the government failed to get its referendum through in October 2011, that means that a parliamentary inquiry can't, for example, come to a conclusion that some individual behaved improperly or is to be blamed in some way for the events of the the last few years. Also, as well, a parliamentary inquiry would, I don't think, be able to get around obstacles on the grounds of cabinet confidentiality, because the constitutional provision in relation to cabinet confidentiality refers only to a court or to a tribunal established under a resolution passed by both houses of the Oireachtas. So there might be an additional impediment there. So what the government seems to be proposing is the most straightforward kind of collation of evidence, I suppose you could say, that a committee could do, which is just that they gather the documents, they bring witnesses in, and then they don't really make any report in relation to it except to set out everything they've heard. And that's what happened after the collapse of the partnership government in 1994, for example, and the question of the appointment of Harry Whelan as a judge of the High Court. People came in, they gave their evidence, and that was left sit there and the public could draw their own conclusions.
And let's admit it, part of that is the putting them in the stocks satisfaction.
Yes.
Just give them a hard time. Yeah. OK, now you mentioned papers. As things stand, could such an inquiry demand and get papers, and from whom?
Oh, yes, no, the powers go back to 1997 to compel people to attend and give evidence and
from
to
banks?
Produce documents. Yeah, no, there's no difficulty about that. The real problem with the inquiries is what happens when you get somebody
right.
before the inquiry and they're entitled to legal representation and how they could be cross-examined.
Yeah, they can
for
demand
example.
And get papers they want from anyone, including
there's
a
no
bank.
There's no difficulty about that, yeah.
Right, OK. So, and how about compelling witnesses? Would a private citizen not be entitled to say to a committee, I'm not going to appear?
Oh, no. A direction can be issued to somebody to appear before a committee. That's never really been the problem, getting people to appear. It's what you do with them once they're before a committee.
OK. Other problems with papers are, first of all, as the Taoiseach said yesterday, there are no papers of the meeting, for example, that of the Cabinet, rather unusual Cabinet meeting with a lot of the ministers not present, which issued the guarantee, agreed to it. There are no papers for that, or indeed for other meetings with bankers. So that's an obvious problem. What about people outside Ireland?
Well, there could be a problem with the European Central Bank, because the European Central Bank is very concerned about its not only its independence in Frankfurt, but also the independence of the national central banks as well, for example, because they're part of a euro system. And that's a matter of European law. So I presume it could be fought out in the Irish courts, not just in terms of the ECB refusing to release documentation, but also perhaps the extent to which the central bank here is allowed to or is compellable to, you know.
Finally, there are three criminal prosecutions pending against individuals in Anglo-Irish, and the Taoiseach said there are more investigations completed and now with the DPP. So what do you think are the realistic prospects for an investigation beginning and getting somewhere and completing its work?
Well, it may begin, but it could be a stop-start process, of course, in terms of having to avoid prejudicing pending prosecutions. I think one of the concerns the eight former attorney generals addressed, for example, in the 2011 referendum was this whole, and the ICCL very successfully launched this theme of a kangaroo court, for example. So I think that's one of the concerns. Interfering with pending criminal prosecutions against people could be a big problem for taking an Oireachtas inquiry forward.
So this will take years before it could get it stuck into
it? I think, well...
And maybe, what are its prospects of getting to the end?
I suppose it would be fair to say that an Oireachtas inquiry could be an opportunity to get more documents out into the public domain and to bring more people before committees, but it may just be a glimpse into behind the curtain, so to speak, rather than laying everything bare.
John O'Dowd, thank you very much. 7:21.
Now, the key people in the new insolvency setup being put in place are the personal insolvency practitioners. The PIPs, as they're known, will be the link between the person who's broke and can't pay their debts and the bank that sold the money. The PIP will negotiate a deal under the new rules in the Personal Insolvency Act. And Lorcan O'Connor, Director of the Insolvency Service of Ireland, you're accepting applications at the moment.
That's correct. Yesterday, the Insolvency Service of Ireland, the ISI, issued regulations pursuant to various provisions within the Personal Insolvency Act that in effect sets out the framework upon which people who are interested in becoming personal insolvency practitioners or indeed approved intermediaries can apply to the ISI for authorisation.
OK, so you've personal insolvency practitioners, you've approved intermediaries. What's the difference between the two to begin with?
OK, the approved intermediaries will be advising people looking for relief under what's called a debt relief note. And typically those individuals will have very little income and very little assets. And the working assumption at the moment is that the approved intermediaries will all be based within the MABS network across the country. And then you have the personal insolvency practitioners who will be advising insolvent debtors for the other reliefs that are introduced through this new act. The debt settlement arrangement, which is for unsecured debt, and the personal insolvency arrangement, which is for both secured and unsecured. So typically including your mortgage, as well as your unsecured debts, which might be a credit card, an overdraft, etc.
Who should apply for being either a PIP or an approved intermediary? Let's concentrate on the PIPs for the moment.
We're not closing the door on anyone, but what we are saying is that to act in this area, you do need to have certain skill sets or experience. At the outset, certainly somebody who is a solicitor or an accountant would have a good starting position, but anyone with a similar qualification would certainly get in the door as such. But we have also identified other aspects required of anyone to be a PIP, such as professional indemnity insurance, fitness and probity tests, tax clearance and so on. But I think the most important aspect that we have introduced is that anyone who does apply has to demonstrate that they know the Personal Insolvency Act inside out, and they know.
So there'll be some kind of test or training
indeed,
process?
And we announced that back in the spring, and there's been a number of courses and indeed exams that have already been held, and by all accounts there's been healthy attendances at those courses, because I think the reality is that nobody really in this country today can offer themselves as genuine experts in personal insolvency, simply because until very recently there has been only been a handful of bankruptcy cases in any given year. So this is a new area, mm-hmm. and this course is designed to ensure that those in a position as a PIP give the right advice to insolvent debtors and help them through this process.
You can see why an insolvent debtor might be a bit nervous. This is obviously going to be a great way to make a lot of money, because there'll be a lot of business mm-hmm. if you're an accountant or a solicitor, and we all know that there's a lot of them out there looking for work. But from the point of view of the person, you know, who's in debt and really worried, is this simply going to be another person they have to pay a whole lot of money to? How do they know for sure that this is the right person for them, who's going to really be working in their interest and not the bank's?
Well, the PIP is carrying out its statutory duties and they are independent. But equally, the insolvent debtor need have nothing to fear. In fact, these PIPs...
But are they independent or are they working for you? If I'm broke and I'm desperately trying to keep my home, I want someone who's acting in my interest. Is this just another professional who's going to say, well, these are the rules and I'll go and talk to the bank for you? Or are they going to be working for me to help me hold on to my home?
What you want is somebody to try and implement one of the new arrangements that the Act introduces, which is voluntary and ultimately is trying to bring a debtor and a creditor to the table to agree a voluntary arrangement. And through this authorisation process, we will ensure that those that are PIPs do have the experience, the skill sets required of that. In terms of the fees,
I'm really asking about the commitment.
Well, there's obviously an obvious commitment there, because ultimately they will get paid out of the arrangement to creditors, and it is therefore in their interest to ensure that both the debtor signs up to it as well as the creditor.
When you said they will get paid out of from the creditors, how will that work?
Well, the way it will work already in very many other jurisdictions, but the way it is intended to work here is that through the development of a proposal or an arrangement, a pot of money is identified that the debtor can contribute to his or her creditors. And out of that, the fees will be deducted. So there will be no direct fees paid by the insolvent debtor. It is actually out of the funds that will be available to the creditors.
All right. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for coming in to talk to us about it. Lorcan O'Connor, who's Director of the Insolvency Service of Ireland, and isi.ie, that's your website if anybody wants.
A helpline number, if I may, for debtors, but also practitioners that may have any queries, which is 076 106 4200.
076 106 4200. We'll put that up on our website and it'll be there for anyone who wants to check on it later today. Lorcan, thank you very much indeed.
Somebody out there isn't going to have a problem with personal insolvency. They may have other problems, indeed opportunities as well, because the National Lottery has said that one of the two winning tickets for last night's EuroMillions jackpot was sold in Ireland. Now, we've no details, no confirmation yet of where or indeed by whom that ticket was purchased, but there are fairly strong rumours, for what that's worth, that the ticket was bought in Riley's Supervalue shop in Salons in County Kildare. And our reporter, Justin McCarthy, has been there and spoke to some people who think something might be afoot.
It's mostly the regular, like, we know the normal people that come in and always have the same numbers, always come in, and then just we know the people that always want a quick pick, so...
And there'll be a bit of excitement here today. I mean, there's a lot of speculation that this was the shop that sold the winning ticket. Would you think you might be able to identify who the winner was if you found out what day the ticket was sold on?
Oh, no, I wouldn't have a clue. The amount of them that I put through the last while, like, since everyone knew it was 108 million, everybody was buying a ticket.
And you're right next to the train station here as well, so a lot of people would be maybe buying a ticket on their way home from work, would they?
Yeah, it's all, like, commuters, like, from Naas and... Clay, and they all just get the drive in here and then get the train up to Dublin. So,
and yourself, did you check your own ticket?
Oh yeah, I checked it online last night. It didn't win anything though.
Will do.
Aisling, you work here, yeah?
Yeah, I do indeed. Yeah.
A lot of excitement here today.
A lot of excitement today. Yeah, it's going to be buzz in the shop today, which will be great. Like, long day, but it'll be great. Yeah.
So, how many people play the EuroMillions Lotto here every day?
Oh, loads and loads. Like, on a Tuesday or a Friday, we're flat out on the lotto machine for the EuroMillions. Like,
So
did you play only won $2,000 there last week on a fella that works here. So the excitement for that, and now it's going to be even bigger today. So.
Yeah, and did you play it yourself?
Yeah, I played it on Tuesday, but no luck. Like,
you checked already?
Yeah, I checked it already.
You wouldn't be here today, would you?
No, I wouldn't be working today if I did win it.
I can understand why. Justin McCarthy talking to some people who had no luck, but somebody, the word is, well, definitely somebody in Ireland. And as I say, the finger is pointing towards Salins and County Kildare. Justin McCarthy's on the line now from there. When we talk about luck, Justin, first of all, what kind of winnings are we talking about?
Well, the actual jackpot, Cathal, was €187 million, and there were two winners of that. One ticket was sold in Belgium, and one ticket was sold in Ireland. And now, as you heard there, the social media in particular and local rumours are alive with speculation that the winning ticket was sold here in Riley's of Salins, which is right next to the train station here. So it could be anybody. As you heard there, the staff there certainly think that they sold the winning ticket. And although it's fairly quiet around this area, anybody who's all of the delivery people and the locals who've been calling into the shop here this morning, it's the first question on their lips: who won the Euro Millions Lotto last night? And the hunt is firmly on now to try and find that winner.
And of course, it did happen before. Dolores McNamara, the previous Irish winner, now she won a little bit more. She got €115 million. Still, €94 million ain't bad. Is there much excitement? Many people interested?
There's plenty people. In fact, all of the staff, as they were arriving this morning, that was the first topic of conversation. Did we sell the winning ticket? Who was it? Who could it have been? And they were going through the lists of people who came in, the regulars who buy the Euro Millions, who mightn't have been seen today. Funnily enough, the owner of the shop, Fergus Riley, is off today. Now, there's no speculation that Fergus won it himself, but because one of the staff was talking to him on the phone, but he picked the wrong day to take off, given the amount of excitement that's going to be around here today.
All right, Justin McCarthy and Salins, do keep us posted. For now, it's 7:31.
Morning, Ireland. 23 minutes to 8. Porrick Lodge is still being attacked by the furniture. But anyway, give us the sports news.
Morning, Anya. This studio isn't built for tall people, I think. Carlos Tevez is to undergo a medical at Juventus today as the striker gets ready to end his four-year spell at Manchester City. The Manchester City director of football met his Juventus counterparts yesterday, and after an agreement from new boss Manuel Pellegrini, it was decided that Tevez should be allowed to leave. The move will go through provided he passes his medical and agrees personal terms. Although Juventus will only be paying an initial €9 million, a further €6 million could be payable if various clauses are met over the course of what is understood to be a 3-year contract. Meanwhile, Liverpool have confirmed the signing of Sunderland's Belgian international goalkeeper Simon Mignolet in a £9 million deal. In rugby, Melbourne Rebels wing Lachlan Mitchell has received a one-match ban for foul play during yesterday's game against the British and Irish Lions. Mitchell was found guilty of lifting Lions wing Simon Zebo and dropping him into the ground. This time tomorrow, the Irish Open Golf will be underway at Carton House in County Kildare. Large crowds are expected to attend on each of the 4 days. A strong Irish challenge for the tournament includes the Ryder Cup captain Paul McGinley, but McGinley has been telling Greg Allen that his Ryder Cup duties very much take a back seat this week.
To be honest, my Ryder Cup duties are left behind this week. This is about me playing, and I'm very keen for the next 2 years not to be a ceremonial captain and go through the motions. It's important for me to remain, I think part of the job is important to remain competitive and be out there and be playing with the guys and standing toe to toe with them. And I'm motivated to have 2 good years in the golf course.
You know, you don't really have to start looking at form until at least this September and probably next year, and the dust has settled since your appointment in January. Are you actually able to kind of really concentrate on your actual golf game at the moment for a while?
It's difficult, there's no doubt, but it's not difficult in a bad way. My life is very exciting at the moment. I've got great things going on. It's all very exciting, and my golf is part of that as well too. And I don't think that the duties I have as Ryder Cup captain should impinge too much on my playing. And I think there's no excuses. I certainly don't feel there's any excuses for not playing well on the golf course the next 2 years.
Yeah, from that point of view, do you have to feel that you want to be a competitive golfer right in through next year so that you can stand toe to toe with the players who you'll be selecting?
That's what I feel. I feel it's very important I remain competitive. I think you really get to know a player and where he's at when you're on the golf course to him, standing toe-to-toe with him and competing with him. And also, you know, I have my own ambitions as well too. I still, you know, play very well. When I'm practicing and playing, I still know I can hit the ball really well and compete. I nearly played really well in Wentworth last month. Unfortunately, I've had 4 weeks off since, so I need a run of tournaments to remain competitive. I played very little this year, and you know, hopefully from now until the end of the year, I'm going to play more tournaments. The more tournaments you play, the more competitive you get, and turn those three shots into two and start shooting some good scores.
That's Paul McGinley there. And another line of golf news is that Lee Westwood has withdrawn from next week's French Open, citing fatigue. He plans to return to action at the British Open in Muirfield. The Cavan football manager Terry Hyland has announced an unchanged starting 15 for Saturday's Ulster football semi-final against Monaghan in Clonus. While a few players are carrying knocks, there are no concerns about their participation. Cavan will be hoping for a third win of the championship, having already beaten Armagh and Fermanagh. Serena Williams is through to the second round at Wimbledon after a comfortable straight sets win over Luxembourg's Mandy Minella. There were also wins in the women's event for Li Na and Agnieszka Radwanska. The top men's seed Novak Djokovic had no problems, but Tommy Haas and Juan Martín Del Potro also progressed. The Irish women's hockey team drew 4-4 with Canada at Belfield. Anna O'Flanagan scored a hat-trick, with Nikki Simmons, who was earning her 201st Irish cap, also on the score sheet. And jockey Andrew Lee says he's badly bruised on his back and chest but has no broken bones following a fall at Kilbeggan on Monday. He's anticipating a 10-day wait before he's ready to return to action.
Thank you very much, Porrick. It's 19 minutes to 8. Anybody who's spent 3 days in an airport will know just how awful that can be. But for the American whistleblower Edward Snowden, the situation is much worse than the ordinary travellers, because, of course, the Americans have withdrawn his passport, and right now he has nowhere to go. The question is, will the Russians accept him? Seems unlikely. And if not, who will? We're joined from Moscow by freelance journalist Tim Wald. Thanks for taking the call. Tim, first of all, any idea where, at the moment, where Edward Snowden is going or might go?
Right. Well, of course, the government of Ecuador is considering his request, and we all know this, for political asylum. But I think that the delay there from the Ecuadorian government is quite significant, because they obviously realise that if they do accept him, this would bring various consequences on their head. The United States is their biggest trading partner in Ecuador. So it could be a little bit tricky for the Ecuadorian government to actually accept him.
What exactly is the line being taken by Vladimir Putin? Because it does seem to rule out any idea of giving him even temporary asylum in Russia.
Right. I think that so far Vladimir Putin has been very careful in the way that he's dealt with this situation. I think he's not being entirely truthful when he says that they learned of his arrival in Moscow from the media, and that Snowden hasn't had any contact with the Russian government. I think that would be highly unlikely. But if Russia was to give asylum to Snowden, that would create quite a serious precedent between Russia and the United States. And I don't think that that is Putin's plan A. Let's put it that way.
Is Putin looking on this as something which is quite handy as a way of embarrassing the Americans, but at the same time is shying away from taking them and getting involved in a full frontal diplomatic row by giving them, as I say, even temporary permission to stay?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the phrase that's being used here in Moscow is that he'd like to tweak the Americans' nose quite a little bit. But if Ecuador does not give Snowden asylum, and I say it's a big step for any government to take on the United States in this way, then it would put quite a lot of pressure on Putin, and I'm sure this is what they've been considering in the Kremlin, as to whether they could actually go ahead and take in Snowden. Whether he, of course, would want to be part of any Russian propaganda is another question entirely.
Venezuela's already said, by the way, they would consider an asylum application from him. We don't know where that's going. But for the moment, are we looking at a standoff with no end in sight? And one thinks of Julian Assange still in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Could we be looking at that possibility in Moscow airport?
I think it is possible. I think it is possible. I mean, Sheremetyevo Airport, of course, it has quite a long tradition of not being a very hospitable place to be, even though it was the Irish company Air Rienta that started the duty-free tradition in the Soviet Union at the airport 20 years ago. I think that it could be rather uncomfortable for all sides if this drags on for a while.
All right. Well, I wasn't going to mention the Irish connection, but thank you for reminding us of it. Anyway, it's a standoff with no immediate end in sight. And thank you very much for telling us where it stands. Tim Wall in Moscow. It's coming up to 7:45.
Now, who says there's no romance in Morning Ireland? Listen to this. Hundreds of love locks attached to the Hapenny Bridge. They're being taken away by Dublin City Council for structural and visual reasons. Now, the idea behind the love locks is that couples who are in love either write or engrave their names onto a regular padlock. Then they fasten the padlock to the railings of the Hapenny Bridge while the key is thrown into the river as a symbol of their everlasting love. You say, ah, here, Cahill.
On cue, ah.
But, there's a but here. Dublin City Council says it's been removing the locks regularly. They want couples to stop and leave their railings alone. Here's more. Aisling Kenny reports.
Love is in the air, everywhere I look around.
Well, we're going to put the lock on the bridge to lock our love together. We've been married for 29 years, and we're here on this trip celebrating our anniversary. And so we're excited to put the lock on the bridge and show our love for each other.
I'm trying to find a spot on the bridge that I can put it on. Okay, I can lock it. Can get it through.
You have it now?
Okay, yes, I do. Okay, here it is. Now it's locked. You want to throw the key away?
I'll throw the key.
But make it big.
Okay.
All the way.
Okay. Okay, ready?
Yes.
Here we go.
Yay, you did it. Give me a kiss. Gracie from Brownsville, Texas.
And I'm Keith, her husband. She was really honestly gave me chills up my spine, so it's very exciting.
I think it's very emotional and loving and caring to show your love for each other in such a way.
Love is in the air.
Love might be in the air for hundreds of couples who've been attaching love locks to the Hapenny Bridge. But for Dublin City Council, there'll be no love lost when the locks are removed.
Owen Madden, I'm Senior Engineer with Dublin City Council in the Traffic Department. For the last 2 years, we've been taking these locks down and they've just been reappearing. Almost as fast as we take them down, they come back again. It's costing us money to actually bring the bridge back, to take the locks back off them, because we're obliged to take the locks off them because the bridge is supposed to look the way it did 180 years ago. Some of these things are made of toughened steel. The bridge it's reconstituted to the original design made of the original cast iron. So the bridge is softer than the locks we have to take off. So we can damage the bridge taking locks off.
Dara Doyle, the community manager of the website worldirish.com, says that the new phenomenon is ruining the bridge's appearance.
It is attracting people to write on the bridge itself and write and scrape in with marker and whatever. And when we're walking across something that should be well painted and should be presented well, given how many photographs it appears in, how many times it's photographed daily, how many postcards and whatever, it should actually be a clean bridge, but people are scribbling on it. And the other thing is, if you look at the locks, you'll actually see that the locks are rusting and they're causing the bridge to rust and they're causing the paintwork on the bridge to be damaged. What would be a lovely idea is just to put a row of wiring down on the boardwalk maybe and have people lock the things to that.
While the tradition is becoming increasingly popular in countries across Europe, people in Dublin city centre had mixed views about the romantic gesture.
I think it's a really nice idea, but because it's such an iconic bridge, it kind of ruins it a little bit because there's so many of them.
I think they're quite gimmicky. I think they can become a problem later on.
I think they're cool. It looks great. They can remove them and they're going to be back anyway.
No, I would keep them. As a tourist, I thought it was a nice little, kind of special, unique thing.
I think it just brings something a little bit different to the bridge. I would leave them, yeah. Sorry about it. Just says something, yeah, about people of Ireland, Dublin, and I would leave it, yeah. No, we wouldn't do it ourselves, but I think it's nice if someone took the time to do it. I think it should be left.
I'm from Denmark. We do the same in Denmark as well. We have a bridge in Copenhagen. We do the same. It's a tradition. I think it's a sweet idea.
I don't really have any opinion on them. I saw them in Paris, so I suppose they're just copying what they've seen abroad. The bridge is beautiful. It doesn't need to have anything added to it.
I think they look lovely. No, definitely, because it's quite quirky. And I've never seen anything like that before, so I think they should stay.
We considered it, but the bars here are very thick. And that's the problem. In Paris, it's more accessible than it is here. But we are sort of still thinking about it.
I think you'd want the right type of lock. You wouldn't want something that's grass or like the bicycle locks or anything like that.
It has to be romantic. We're very romantic, because even though we're in our 50s.
Oh, wasn't that great? That was Aisling Kenny reporting. And so you've a choice there. You know, you can say it's an historic bridge that's being defaced with rusting locks, or you could be like I signed up Dave and his fiance, and their lock was on the bridge. So I hope Dublin Corporation
they did the same thing, and they've been doing it for years on the Rialto Bridge in Venice, and apparently on the Great Wall of China and a couple of other places. But there's something about bridges. I mean, it's a beautiful bridge. Therefore, we have to stick a couple of hundred thousand padlocks
love.
On it.
Anyhow, leave love aside. It's time for the business news, Emma.
Thanks very much, Anya. While demand for credit among smaller and medium-sized businesses remains low, almost one in five loan applications is still being declined by the banks. That's according to a new survey commissioned by the Department of Finance. The survey by Red Sea also shows an increase in loan refusals among the non-pillar banks. There have been, though, improvements in turnover performance among medium-sized businesses, which led to a small increase in those looking for finance. Red Sea's Richard Colwell is with us in studio. Richard, can you give us an overall picture of what it's like out there for a small business looking for money?
I think at the moment what we're seeing from the survey for this period is relatively stable. The backdrop is that medium and small companies are doing relatively okay. They're stabilising, certainly, in terms of their business. And because of that, credit demand is up very slightly on the previous period.
One of the things going against the banks is that the Department of Finance has guidelines about how long they should, the banks should take to give an answer or approval. And some of the banks are taking too much time to give approval for these loans.
Yes, still slightly higher than the Department of Finance guidelines, which are 15 days, and the average is 21 days at the moment, so that is still longer than their guidelines. One of the things, though, that we do look at is whether that has any impact on refusal or granting of the credit, and it doesn't appear that if it takes longer that you're more likely to be refused. In fact, the opposite is the case.
How do you think the banks come out of this overall?
I think they come out okay. I think there's still work to be done. I think particularly with micro businesses, there's a need potentially to encourage micro businesses to give more formal applications. At the moment, a lot of micro businesses are giving informal applications, and because of that, they're not being given credit.
Also, one of the things you mentioned is the tighter conditions on loans. Like what? What's harder?
Yes. Well, what's happened is that the banks have actually started giving full loans rather than partial loans. But what they've done as a result is give more conditions on those loans. So things like bank guarantees, personal guarantees, checking of credit and so on. So, you know, there's just more of that coming because the banks are actually giving the full loan rather than part of it.
And what do you think is the most problematic area of credit in terms of maybe overdraft or loan extensions?
It's definitely restructuring. I mean, and it's micro businesses that are having the most problem with getting credit because they're more likely to be in a difficult position, with the larger companies more stable. The smaller companies are the ones that are having problems.
At a press conference yesterday with these figures, you said it might have been nicer to see more positive results. What do you hope to see next time around?
Well, I think the most positive thing to come out of this is that actually there's quite a large increase in the number of businesses who feel that the banks are lending. And I think hopefully that will encourage more people to actually look for credit in the next 6 months, and we might see a significant improvement.
Richard Colwell from Red Sea, thanks very much for joining us in studio this morning. Now elsewhere, Flock, a social media platform for business, says it can create 100 jobs over the next 18 months after raising investment of over €450,000. It's intended to boost business by incentivizing rewards and helping businesses stay in contact with their local customers. We're joined by Flock's founder, Paul Graham. In a nutshell, Paul, what is Flock?
Flock is really just a platform that helps local businesses reconnect with the people who live around them. We encourage shop local using a virtual currency that incentivizes people to come there more often. Think of it almost like one of the large supermarket loyalty cards, but for Main Street.
And is it modeled on something else, or was it all your own idea?
No, it's all my own idea. Myself and my co-founder, Kelvin McKay, who's our lead developer, we felt the pain ourselves in another business we were in, a company called Clarity Telecom that I founded. It's still trading today across Ireland. But we tried to use social media for it, and it didn't work. And a long story short is when I talked to a lot of businesses about that problem, they were all experiencing the same thing. The biggest one was they couldn't even get an audience, never mind incentivize them to come and spend money with them in their stores or their business. So what we had to do was evolve what was out there already in social media to suit that marketplace more easily.
Now, you've raised rather a lot of money, €450,000 or more. How did you do that?
It was an interesting journey. You do the rounds, you do the pitches. We were either over in San Francisco pitching over there. But ultimately, I met an angel investor in one of our client's stores in a coffee shop in Malahide. He was using the product, loved it, and wanted to invest. And we used that as the stepping stone into raising more structured venture capital funds to match it. And that's how we got there.
Well, Phlox, Paul Graham, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Those 100 jobs which Paul Graham is confident of creating are for software engineers, sales and team management staff. On the currency markets this morning, the euro is trading at $1.3074 and 84.68 pence sterling.
Emma, thank you very much indeed for that. 3 minutes to eight now, and time to get the weather forecast from David Rogers at Met Aaron.
Hello and good morning from Met Éireann. Well, it'll be dry today with sunny spells developing in most parts of the country. Winds are mostly light northwesterly, but moderate onshore breezes will set in locally by this afternoon. It'll become warm except in coastal margins affected by these sea breezes. Highest temperatures today 15 to 20 degrees Celsius. It's going to remain dry for a time tonight with broken cloud. However, the cloud will fill in everywhere overnight and rain will spread to many parts of Connacht, Ulster and North Leinster by morning. Winds tonight will be light northwest to west and lowest temperatures will range 7 to 10 degrees Celsius. Rain and drizzle will become widespread on Thursday morning and will continue in many places until late evening tomorrow. However, south and east Munster will become drier and possibly brighter before then. Winds are going to become moderate westerly tomorrow and it'll turn quite humid. The rain and drizzle will become confined to northern and western coastal counties on Thursday night, but outbreaks of rain or drizzle will then return to many parts of the country during Friday, although the southeast will stay mainly dry and bright until late in the day. Clearer conditions will develop generally on Friday night as the rain and drizzle moves away, Saturday then starting dry and bright in all areas, with the south and east likely to have some spells of warm sunshine, but drizzle will come to affect the west and northwest again as the day goes on. During Sunday, rain will spread eastwards to affect most parts of the country, but the southeast will probably continue dry until nightfall. Monday next may turn out to be generally dry and bright, but rainy or drizzly conditions seem set to spread from the Atlantic yet again on Tuesday next. And the week ahead will be characterised by southwest to west winds, which are unlikely to be very strong at any stage. Temperatures will be about normal or a little above, and frequently high humidity will make it feel clammy much of the time. These conditions, along with the intermittent rain and drizzle, favour the spread of potato blight in the coming days, but today's fair weather will be suitable for preventative spraying operations. And that's the forecast this morning.